For every parent that's homeschooling, and for every child that's learning, there's a teacher working for us. We'd like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Clemenin Podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell.
Well, hello there and welcome to another edition of the Clemenin Podcast. What you have just heard is what I think is the most joyous tonic to what has been a challenging few weeks. It is the most wonderful call to arms and campaign video, giving everybody a chance to say those vitally important words. Thank you to our teachers. Em, tell us a bit more about how it happened.
Yeah, I just got really, really fed up, actually really genuinely miserable hearing from so many teachers on their knees, from planning lessons, delivering lessons all day, marking all evening, planning schemes of work late into the night for September, and just saying, look, we're trying our absolute best and it just doesn't seem to be good enough. One teacher contacted me and she said, I've been told today that I'm setting too much work, that I'm setting too little work, that my work's too hard, that my work's too easy. So there's this real sense with teachers at the moment. Is that not just teachers, I should say, all school staff, because TAs are working incredibly hard, office administrators, it's just, they just can't win. There's this teacher bashing that seems to come out of nowhere. So we just wanted to do something, and there's not much we can do from our desks with our microphones, but we decided to put together this campaign video.
For every parent that's homeschooling, and for every child that's learning,
and it was a flash of inspiration from the amazing Sam Twistleton, OBE, and Sarah Mullen. And within 24 hours, we had, hundreds of submissions from young people saying thank you, and hundreds more from teachers, which we're going to use hopefully in future weeks. And it's lovely. And I've watched it and listened to it so many times now, and it makes me giggle every single time. And it brings me a little shot of joy and adrenaline. So huge thank you to teachers.
It's just gorgeous. Yeah, and we got a celebrity. Thank you to our amazing celebrity. Yeah, tell us a bit about him.
Oh, the beautiful David Morrissey, inside and out. He is quite lovely. We're just delighted to get such a big hitter. He was on The Walking Dead, wasn't he? He's just
incredible.
So cool. I've met him, Clem. I met him,
and
I did. I did. Yes, we went to the theatre. He was acting, and
wow.
I did that thing I do with celebrities, which I just go all
awkward
shy,
fangirling,
can't speak, but just but I just sort of can't step away from them either. So I just sort of lurk.
That.
Silently.
Well, you clearly had the impact, because he has done the most beautiful voiceover to bring together these beautiful strands of thanks and love and gratitude. And it's just the most amazing thing to be involved in. So go and have a look. It's pinned on our Twitter feed. Have a look, see what you think, and certainly share any gratitude and thanks you want to share with our brilliant profession, because I've never been more proud of all of us, and long may that continue.
We started a conversation last week about women and their bodies. And actually, our guest has quite passionate feelings about this. You'll hear from her in a bit. And then you texted me the next morning saying, I actually feel quite sick, because we heard from all sorts of women, from one woman who'd been told off by her mother for airing their dirty laundry because she shared a blog about her miscarriage, to another one, and I'm going to read this one. This is from someone called Catherine, and she says, I had my first child by emergency cesarean after labouring for 14 hours. My mum told me, it's a shame you couldn't do it properly. With my next, I had my mum stand at the foot of the bed to see me do it properly. So, yes. So it's staggering.
It is staggering. And what's really funny is that last one you read out, I had the exact opposite experience, where I actually delivered my little brother. I don't know if you know this.
We may
have talked about it before. I did. I delivered Oscar when I was 12 years old.
Is this within the Stewart Circle of Trust? Are you bringing the Stewart family into, after you said your father didn't love you enough last week?
So much hassle from that, by the way. Oh my God.
Jesus, what can of worms did we open? Dad, I know you love me and I love you too. But yeah, it's an extraordinary story. But basically, my mum was obviously pregnant with Oski and I was about 12 years old. And we've been through some difficult challenges previously. And I think my mum wanted my takeaway of pregnancy to be a positive thing and a happy thing. So when she went into labor, she said to me, do you want to come to hospital and be part of it? And I thought, yeah, why not? You know, I don't want to stay at home. I'll come. So jumped in the car with them. And then there was this amazing maternity nurse. Is that what you call them? Maternity nurse? Or no, midwife. Midwife, thank you. Who basically said, well, if you're going to be here, you might as well be useful. And before I knew it, I was wearing an apron. I was down at what I would call the business end. I don't know if that's a nice way of putting it. And the next thing she's saying, pull it like a rugby ball. And I'm pulling and I cut his cord. I did the whole lot. And to this day, he still blames me for his half innie, half outie. But half innie, I delivered.
Belly button.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yes, okay. Okay. Took me a second.
Yeah, half innie, half outie, tummy button. I made that. And we have been ever so close ever since. I absolutely adore him. There's a huge age difference between us. But yeah, I delivered him. So there we go. So my dad, on the other hand, ate chips. And watch TV and sign some autographs, which makes him sound worse than he is. I think by number four, he kind of seen it all and done it all. But yeah, I think
you need to reel it in, Clem. Poor Alistair.
He's had a real bashing. He has. But no, and it was, in all seriousness, it was an amazing experience. And yeah, my dad was amazing too. And then my brothers came in to hold Oscar and it was this amazing family experience. And then of course, my mum she was a little bit older when she had had Oski. So my big brother and I then took it in turns to do night feeds when she was really tired. So I've kind of had this whole experience. Seeing all these women's experience coming in on Twitter, just wow, brought in some incredible emotions, I think, for all of us.
We have been doing some master stalking this week. You can hear the glee and the pride in my voice. I have become such a professional stalker recently. If there is anyone you would like us to stalk, do contact us at Clem and M because we're becoming quite good at this. Now, I think Rav has said that he's turning the swear filter off this week. This may or may not be necessary. But we have a lady who has written a book in which she talks about how much she loved school, but how her teachers seemed to find her really annoying because she never had a hairbrush, and we really want to explore this. We are with the fantastic stand-up comic Janie Godley. Janie, welcome.
Hiya, thank you so much for having me on. I've been excited about it all week. It's been ages since I've sat in front of a computer and spoke. I'm joking. But I have been excited about doing it. I feel as though my whole life is now talking to my own screensaver. That is now my life, so this is cool.
And seeing yourself on a screen of Skype or Teams, I've learned some of the most unflattering experiences you can live.
It's unbelievable. I'm doing a thing for the National Theatre of Scotland. I've written a thing and we have rehearsals every day. And all I can do all the way through it is go, oh my God, my lampshade is filthy behind me. That's what's going through my head. I need to repaint that wall, or my wee sausage dog interrupts me and tries to lick my mouth while I'm in mid monologue. it's like these are not problems I normally have. Oh my God, I need to do my roots. Why am I looking at myself? So yeah, it's been very weird, but I feel as though I've been preparing for this for a long time, because my daughter and I, we've been podcasting for 10 years and we've been making online videos, so we were kind of ahead of the game in speaking to ourselves for a long time.
That's quite helpful. It sounds like you've got your own sort of strand of self-judginess going on there, in fact. Yes. And Emma and I were just talking before you came on about judginess, and it was actually a theme we picked up on our podcast last week with some journalists, and it started this whole thread on Twitter about judginess around women, particularly and pregnancy and that question of women in their 30s about when they're going to have babies. It's quite extraordinary. Did you have that experience?
Yeah, I was married 6 years before I had a baby. And I'm a Protestant who married a Catholic, which is a very specific thing in Glasgow called sectarianism and anger. I'm a Protestant who married a Catholic. We had a theme wedding. The theme was hatred. And it carried on for a while. So I had a pub and I used to have my husband's aunties come in and they'd be men in the bar. And they would come up and go, are you no pregnant yet? I'm like, the pill's been invented, Bunny. What is wrong with you? Actually, I'm not having babies because I like it up the bum, and I don't, but I just said that to stop them from asking me any more questions. And they never asked that question again. The men in the bar loved that answer, I have to say.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, just people having agency over your womb. I was 6 years married and I didn't have to have a baby straight away. Everybody in my family was pregnant before they get married. So obviously I was a witch because I wasn't pregnant and I could read. So they were like, get her in the Clyde. So, yeah.
It was quite an extraordinary theme, I think it's safe to say. And I was saying to Emma jokingly, it's if anything, it's actually put any plans I might have had to have children back by at least 2 years as women shared their wonderful birthing stories, which I just didn't really need to hear.
Oh,
The birth was fine. Ashley was fine. I had 9 months of hyperemesis gravidium, so I just vomited for 9 months. Oh, the birth was nothing on the 9 months of fucking having car sickness for 9 months. I couldn't wait to get That's her out horrendous. So I could actually swallow my own saliva. So I was like, the breath was nothing.
Oh, Jesus. Were you working when all this? Oh.
Yeah, I had a pub. I used to go, oh, again, it's no problem. I'm just going to the back to get a clean glass. And then come back out and serve. 9 months. 9 months of that. I was even vomiting in labour because it was like,
oh my God.
I couldn't stop. Yeah, I know. And
well, Jane, you just take me for 2 years to 3 years.
Yeah. That's why I only have one child, that, and I don't breed well in captivity. So, you know.
Fair enough.
Actually,
I love it.
I did take it upon myself after having children. I was so indignant that nobody tells you about all this stuff. And I was sitting on this rubber ring for about 2 weeks, you know, just trying to make polite faces to the in-laws while they tried to clean my house and I hissed at my husband. I took it upon myself to teach my sixth formers all about episiotomies and what your chances are of having one, and your chances are of having a miscarriage and everything else, because I just thought, well, I didn't know any of this reality. Yeah. So you damn well will. And I don't care for it in a French lesson.
I was saying this to Ashley the other week in Glasgow when I was pregnant. It was a famous old hospital called the Rotten Row, and it's just a historic name because it's the street where they used to take the dead bodies during the plague. Lovely, let's build a maternity hospital there. But the maternity hospital was built on a 90-degree hill, and I'm not exaggerating.
Oh, my God.
And I remember when I used to go to prenatal classes, they had an iron bar up the hill to hold on to. Pregnant, you get up to the top and then they'd put you on a mat and say, would you want to relax? We were all asleep because we climbed a hill pregnant. And then as soon as you had the baby, you went down the hill in the pram and almost killed it on the main road at the bottom.
Right. Janie, I clumsily paraphrased a couple of lines from your book earlier. Tell us about what school was like for you.
I loved school. I had, because I had such a chaotic childhood, I had been abused as a child, and my own living environment was very, very difficult because when people talk about child abuse, is it okay to talk about child abuse on this podcast? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. When people talk about it, they often talk about, and quite rightly so, the horror of the act, the damage that it left. What few people ever talk about is how children learn the amazing skill of dodging their abuser. And I spent a lot of time learning new skills to avoid my creepy uncle. So school was great because it was the one place he couldn't get into. So I loved school. Excuse me, I'm burping. I loved school. And I had a great teacher called Miss Miller who always encouraged me. And I remember we would write like short stories. And I was always a scruffy kid. We had nits, we had scabies. There was a lot of poverty and chaos in my house. And I remember once I drew this picture for the Sunday Post newspaper. And what happens is whatever drawing gets picked, the school gets an encyclopedia. And the teacher had entered everybody's picture for this competition. Anyway, long and short is I won the competition. But Miss Miller took me to the headmaster's to announce that the school is getting this big encyclopedia, and the headmaster says she can't present it to the school. She's dirty. She's in front of me. She's dirty. She's a mess. She doesn't have a school uniform. And there's this boy in my class called David who was always perfectly turned out. He's quite a slavery mouth. I remember he couldn't quite control his saliva. He always had a juicy mouth. So I was like, blah, 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 blah. That's what I remember about this boy. You know, somebody
I hate him already.
Poor David. But anyway.
Perfect David.
He was also a bully. He once kicked me under the table and I punched him in the face. So of course, it was my fault for punching
his juicy
mouth. Yeah. So anyway. The amount of splashback was frightening, but anyway, David was to present this award to the school. I, as a child who had been abused and been through a lot of shit, just went, well, that's what happens, you know, as you guys know, children just go, yeah, that's exactly right, why would it be me? And we came out, and I'll never forget Miss Miller, and I can describe her perfectly. This was the mid-60s, so she was this really trim, slim woman, and she was a miss, so she was single. And she'd short bobbed hair, a very round oval face, very pretty mouth, and she'd glasses, and she always wore like a tweed skirt and a wee pair of K-skips and a nice top. She was very modest, but she was a brilliant teacher. And when we left the headmaster's office, she was still holding my hand, and it was a long corridor. The school was built in the 50s, so it was quite a modern school by then. And as we were walking along this corridor, I was quite happy going, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter. And she was, I could, you know how you can feel somebody's fury? I could, and I'd never seen her lose it. She was always very composed and very sweet and nice. And she stopped in the middle of this corridor, and she bent down and she looked at me and she went, this is wrong. That's wrong. What he said is wrong. You must never, ever let men, so obviously she's had her daily at back in the 50s and 60s, you must never let men tell you that how you look will overtake how you are. One day you're going to be a fabulous writer and all these people will be wrong. And she was crying. And I was like, oh, calm down, Miss Miller, it's fine. This is what normally happens. And she was so furious and her hand was shaking and she had a wee handkerchief tucked up her sleeve and she dabbed her eyes and she went, come on. And I went back to the class, and then on the day the encyclopedia got presented to the school, she took me out of class and her and I went to a cafe and we had a milkshake. She wouldn't even attend. Miss Miller was brilliant. Here's to the Miss Millers of this.
Here's to Miss Miller. And it's so interesting that you talk about that, because I suppose I have to hope there's a Miss Miller in every school. And I think what's come out for me over the last few weeks is, what is the purpose of school? Is it to teach children, or is it to fill the world with Miss Millers to look after these children who aren't being looked after at home? And, you know, there's all this talk at the moment about reopening schools. And I think that my desperation is to get all of those children who need that safe place, like you're talking about, to be back in school. I mean, what have your reflections been on the purpose of schools over the last few weeks, do you think?
Watching so many people say, oh, teachers, yous have got a hard job. We didn't know how hard it was. Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. You always knew how hard it was. You just didn't want to recognise how hard it was. You just wanted to pretend that the minute you dropped your kid off at school, all they were doing was making My Lovely Autumn with a couple of leaves. No, you always knew how hard it was.
That's brilliant.
Schools are, you know, education has been the one thing that has been such a mark on my life, because I never got educated. I left school at 16 because I had no shoes to go to school. So I just left school. I never got a further education. I tried to go to night school and get my O-levels, but I couldn't afford it. But, you know, schools aren't just about arithmetic and My Lovely Autumn and you know, English and compositions. There are people out there, and I mean hundreds of thousands of teachers out there, who spot that child who doesn't have a comb for their hair, who know that child has came to school without breakfast. And there's teachers saving their lives every single day. And that is something that people don't really like talking about, because they would rather just assume they were people who were alcoholics at the weekend and got 6 weeks off in the summer. And it's not true. So
you're the third person to have seriously adverse conditions at home and to talk about school as that protective factor. Right at the beginning, we spoke to Camilla Tominey, who went to an independent school, and she felt that actually the fact that her school was an independent school meant that it gave her more protective factors than a state school might have done. Wondering if you've got any thoughts on that one.
Well, my daughter went to a private school. That's the one thing I did, is I saved up money, and the first thing I did, and against all my socialist beliefs, was send Ashley to a private school. But there was a reason. You've got to remember, we were in the Calton, in a pub in the east end of Glasgow, with Celtic, Catholic, Protestant, Rangers, and my husband's father was an old gangster. So I couldn't send Ashley to the local school, because every single child whose grandfather had been beaten in that pub was going to take turns at punching her in the wee posh face. So, and plus the fact it was a safety issue, and also I wanted her to get a really good education. The only thing I had was money. So I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do drugs. The whole 80s passed me by. Everybody else was dying of heroin. I'm like, let's look up independent schools. What? we decided, and we never had a fancy house. We never bought leather suites. We never went to Marbella. We never did the whole Duran Duran lifestyle, hanging off a yacht, snorting coke. We sent our kid to a private school. That's where all our income went to. And she went to a very small, independent, all-girls school up in the west end of Glasgow. And it was perfect for her, you know, and it was small classes. Then when she got to about 12 or 13, it gets sold to a big independent school over in the south side. And she hated that because it took her out. This was a very feminist school. They had big, giant photographs in the hall of the 1900s of women, hundreds of women ironing clothes. And underneath it, it says, "You never need to do this." I thought, oh, I like this school. And it was run by two women, two elderly spinsters back in the 1890s. They started it because they couldn't get into university. So they decided to educate girls. And that's why I picked it.
I love that. I don't know if you know, Jenny, probably not, but I'm ahead of an all-girls school and also ahead of an all-boys school. And so things like that I find absolutely fascinating. And we've had to work really hard recently with our girls to not think that they're better than the boys. Mm-hmm. And it's been really interesting because it's very easy to fall into that rhetoric of boys are better than girls, girls are better than boys.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we're striving for in both is just genuine equality and respect. But I think girls have got to travel a bit further to achieve that, unlike boys.
Headmistress was Miss Eggington, and as soon as Ashley met her, she burst into Eglington, a song from some Disney cartoon, and they loved that Ashley was singing and dancing. They used to get her up to sing and stand on a table, and the Deadwood stage is coming all up. She'd be having
Calamity
songs.
Jane.
They loved that she was this weird, outspoken. I mean, I know our teachers now. We've met, and one of them, I forget her name, but this one teacher, she says we used to laugh. Ashley came into school one day and she said, my mum says that when you're not here, you're in that back bit drinking some beer. She went, tell your mum it's gin we drink up here, you know. They were funny with her. And they loved the spirit of her madness, you know. But then when she went to the big, big school, and because she had always been with this very small group of women, Ashley got thrown into this giant school that thousands of people in it. And I remember she says she was walking through the hallway and this female teacher says, Ashley Story. She went, yeah. She went, do you know who I am? And Ashley went, no. She went, I'm the assistant headmistress. Ashley went, oh, well done you, getting a really good job, and marched on, because she thought that was the end of that conversation. She didn't know that she was being pulled up for not having a tie right. But she got thrown into this different dynamic where it was boys and girls, and there was a lot of really, the mean girls that were always trying to please the jock boys. And she didn't understand that. Plus, she'd been doing comedy since she was 11. So she was a sarcastic witch. So when she went to this big mixed school and the boys are like, we don't like you. She's like, I think you ejaculate talcum. What's your problem? And they're like, what? 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 Why would you say that? She went, oh, I'm sorry. Was I not supposed to answer back? Was I supposed to put on makeup and hope you'd pick me for the ball? Well, let you know, I'm Carrie and I'm carrying pig blood, so move on, pony boy. So she was really outspoken to me because she didn't know that you had to, because she'd been doing stand-up as well. So she didn't understand that these big jock boys all had to be bowed down to. She's like, what's wrong with you? Answer them back. And they're like, no, that's the boys. And she's like, I'm going to pay a junkie to scratch his car. I don't know why he is. I'm worried about this.
She sounds incredible. I mean, when you look at her, what makes you most proud? What kind of stands out for you?
Her compassion. Ashley has got, she's the sassiest bastard I know. But, oh my God, the compassion that she has makes me cry. We've got a comedy club locally called the Stan Comedy Club, and they don't do it now, but for many, many years they pay you in a wee brown envelope. And Ashley could not pass a homeless person when she had money on her. She would spread her wages, her comedy wages, all the way up and give money to the homeless standing in the street. Or she'd step in if there was a fight and somebody was being bullied, or if anybody gets any sort of backstage, somebody's being sarky, she'd be like, hey, no, you can't do this. It's okay being gossipy and bitchy's fine, but don't bully people. She's got, whereas I would have just shut my mouth and put my brown wage packet and carried on with my head down, because I've lived through a lot of poverty and I understand how that feels. Not that I would ignore the homeless. Mm. But
do you think that's the difference?
She's got such compassion for people that I don't possess that much compassion.
Do you think it's because she can afford to have that compassion because she hasn't had that same background and experience that you have?
No, I think it's always been part, even when she was a wee girl in the pub, and she knew that we owned the pub, she knew that we owned the building, but she would still always go her way. If there was a kid being bullied or a child being ignored, she'd be the one that would go and pull them in and say, let's be friends, come with me. And she'd always had that. I think being an only child as well made her realise that it's hard being lonely in a sense. But she's got a great sense of compassion, and I'm really proud of that. And I'm rather cynical and hard-bitten at times. Not that I'm not charitable and not that I don't help people, but she would go that step further all the time. You know, she would be at a nightclub and she'd see a girl drunk and she'd cut her drinking off and go and help the drunk girl get home. Whereas I'd be like, come on, we'll get you a taxi. Ashley would be in the taxi to make sure she got into the house. You know, she's got that kind soul in her. And I really think that's a wonderful thing. She's got such, and then when the lockdown happened, she found some of her friends who were lost their jobs and lost their money and couldn't pay their rent, and she was helping them out as well. And she's like, if we can't help people, who are we? Can't do that, you know? So I'm really proud of that. She's got that kind of really sweet soul. I don't know where she got it, babe, but she's got that.
Is she locked down with you? Are you together now?
Yeah, she's in lockdown with us. Yeah, she's got a radio show tonight at the BBC. She's got her own show. She's had it for a couple of years, and her TV show's on the Thursday night. But her radio show, she's on 10 o'clock till 1, BBC Radio Scotland, every single week. She does it from her bedroom.
Oh, do you think she'd mind if we stalked her?
She would love it. She's dead sweet. She's a good girl. I really love her. And people always are amazed that we've got such a good relationship. They always think that behind closed doors we're like mummy dearest and I'm knocking shit out of her coat hanger. But we're not. We really do love each other, you know. We're really cool together.
I'm not sure my children will be that compassionate about me after this many weeks of lockdown, but...
we've banged in each other a few times in the hall and she's like, move out of the way, there's not this much room, go into your room, mum. No, okay, so we're good with each other.
Tell us a bit more. So if you were, we always ask this question, but if you were a teacher, have you ever considered teaching actually yourself?
No.
That was very quick.
No, I love kids. I absolutely love children. I love being with kids. I'd rather spend my life with children than I would with adults any time of the day. And I'm the favourite auntie in the family because I'm the one that gets an ironing board out, puts it right down because ironing boards can go to any height, and put wallpaper over it. And then we all sit and draw and colour in. I'm the one that makes puppet games. I'm the one that gets all the Barbies out and makes them say slightly rude words behind a very strange curtain. And we do our own theatre. I'm that. And I love kids.
So you basically are one deep down.
Absolutely. Well, I never really got to grow up, so I still like being the child that I am. And I love being around children. I just, my nieces and nephews would tell you that I'm the cool auntie, because of course I'm the auntie who's a stand-up comedian. I'm the cool aunt that gets to do things that people of all ages enjoy. So I've kind of defied the auntie, old auntie age as well.
Oh, so come on though. Let's imagine. Let's be hypothetical here. If you were a teacher, what would you be like in the classroom?
I would be an art teacher. I wouldn't be wearing a bra like my art teacher. I would be a proper hippie art teacher because I love art and I paint as well.
That could get dangerous.
Yeah, no, but my art teacher was a proper hippie in the 70s. She never wore a bra and she wore cheesecloth tops and she swore and smoked. And she was a proper hippie. But she could have been hanging about with Emerson, Lake and Palmer and gone to Woodstock, even though Woodstock had been over by 10 years. She would have been that woman. I loved my old art teacher.
She sounds cool.
She did, and she was brilliant. She used to shout, "There's no such thing as bad art. It looks a bit shit, but it'll be eye-okay for somebody."
You know? Oh, I needed her to teach me. My God, I'm so bad at art.
She was a really free and easy old hippie, so I loved her. And she always used to say, she used to come over, she had a cigarette in her mouth. She used to come over and go, "Oh, I like what you're doing. That's really good. What is that? I don't know. Good answer." So I loved her.
She sounds amazing.
These teachers that you talk about that obviously had a massive influence. Have you ever managed to tell them?
Well, there was a teacher in secondary called Mr. Burgess. Mr. Burgess was my guidance teacher. And he looked like John Thaw. And I put a picture up of him recently. And people went, "My God, he really does look like John Thaw, the Sweeney." And Mr. Burgess in the 70s realised that I was coming to school as a teenager without a jacket because we were poor and it was cold. And my mum and dad had split up by then, so the whole thing had went incredibly chaotic at this point. And he was the only person that gets so close to me telling him that I was being abused. He took me into the guidance room, and he's a man, so there you go, confounds all the stereotypes. And he sat me down and he said, "Jeannie, what is going on?" And I said, "My mum is on Valium tablets and my brother's quite violent." And I just went quiet. I was about to say, "I have an uncle who's abusing me," but I just couldn't find. And he just sat there quiet and he never pushed me. And he just went, "Is there something else you're not telling me?" I went, "Yeah." And he went, "Is there anything I can do about it?" I said, "No." He went, "Okay, well, you need to know that if there is anything," and he gave me his phone number. He went, "You can," and it's nobody had phones. So and then one day I was coming into school and it was the middle of winter in 1974. It was really cold and I didn't have a jacket. So I was just going to school in the freezing cold in the jumper. And he came in the next day and he says, "Jeannie, my daughter is the same age as you and she has a duffel coat. Now, would it be okay if I gave you this coat? You wouldn't be offended." And I said, "No, it's a brand new duffel coat." So what I did was I got the compass with my maths kit and I ripped it inside the lining. He went, "What are you doing?" I said, "If my mum sees this, she'll put it in the pawn or she'll sell it." So I had to, and I never saw a man cry. He actually had to walk away. He was crying. And I had to, because he didn't understand what I was doing, but I was damaging it inside so that my mum wouldn't sell it or put it in the pawn. And I had, and I've got a picture of me in that duffel coat. So years later, when I wrote my book, I wrote a lovely piece about him. And his daughter came to see me. He had died before I got to speak to him, but she said he'd read the book and he said he never did enough for me. And I said, "No, he definitely did. He gave me faith and humanity, and he gave me a duffel coat, and he used to give me money for lunch sometimes when I was hungry. And he also let me run errands for everybody in the school, so I got to know all the gossip. Like Mrs. Thompson would give me a note that says, "Go up and ask Angus McNeil for a Lenny £5 and I would be the messenger. And they kind of trusted me because I wasn't a bad girl at school. I was really good at school and I wasn't chaotic in school and I wasn't displaying any behaviour that normally children who have been abused, not normally, that's the wrong way, but I wasn't externally displaying chaotic behaviour. I was a very good pupil and I loved learning. So and I was funny as well and they liked chatting to me. But Mr. Burgess was great and I'm still friends with his daughter to this day.
Oh, how wonderful.
What would it have taken for you to tell him? Because when he let that silence just sit there, what stopped you from telling him everything?
Well, the problem is, when you're a child and you're being abused, you hold the whole secrets of the family. I know the minute I tell him, the authorities come in, Mama goes insane, my dad tries to kill my uncle. The chaos that's already there is now doubled into another chaos, and it blows the lid off. One thing that people have to remember about children who are being abused, it's not just the abuse that's the problem, it's that you have to carry the responsibility of the ability to throw a hand grenade right into your family circle and incredibly wreck that. Because when I did come out about the abuse, it wrecked that, as I suspected. Yeah. So as a child, you're carrying the one thing that can blow the whole thing out of the water. And you don't want to do that. My mum was already screwed up. She was already in mental hospitals. My dad was an alcoholic. The family was already in bits. What would have happened? My dad would have just killed David Percy. By the way, he already got charged and he got put in prison and he's now dead. Yeah. But my dad would have killed him. And then my dad would have went to prison, so...
And that resourcefulness you talked about earlier, that there's a line from your book which just really... really hasn't left me at all, which is the line about why you taught yourself to be left-handed.
Because my uncle, my abusive uncle, used to make me touch him with my right hand, so I taught myself to be left-handed so that I would never have to use that hand again, which is insane because of course it, but I became completely ambidextrous, and I never knew it was weird until I was drawing and painting a picture at the same time. And my husband, who was about 17 at the time, because we get married young, he went, "What weird sorcery is this?" I was like, "Doesn't everybody draw and paint at the same time?" with two hands.
You were tiny when you taught yourself to do that as well, weren't you?
Yeah, I was about five.
And then you threw that grenade. What was the impact on your family? What was the publicity?
My mum was dead. My mum was murdered when I was 21, so she was long gone. My dad had remarried. He'd come off the booze. He was sober. So when I told them in the 90s, my dad was horrified. He broke down in tears. And then I went to the police and I gave a statement. My sister also had been abused, so she corroborated. And it took years to get him to court, but we did, and we got him found guilty. And then one of my friends broke his arms and beat him near to death in the prison that first night because it was my birthday.
That was the gift. My God.
Yeah. And even in court, they said things like, "Oh, well, you're," because I was been doing stand up at that point. And even in court, they said things like, "Oh, well, you're a comedian. Clear, you're a liar." I remember saying to the jury and the judge, "Yeah, this has been the longest punchline ever. Since I was five, I've been working on this punchline for about 30 years to get to this bit and say," and then I was abused. Because we all know the BBC only hire abused comedians. What is wrong with you? And I said to his lawyer, "Would you let him babysit your kids knowing what you know about them?" And the judge says, "You're not allowed to ask him questions." I went, "Once he can't answer." And so he got found guilty. But yeah, I mean, my aunt never spoke to me again, who's called Janie Godley, who I'm called after. She's never spoken to me since. But there wasn't many of the family left. You know, my mum had died, my auntie Rita was dying, and there was just David and my aunt Janie left, and my granda was dead. So there wasn't many of those creepy f***ers left to be upset at. And my dad stood by me, my brothers and sisters stood by me, and, you know. Children can wreck their whole family, and that's what they have in their head. And people don't think about that. They don't think about you. As a teacher, you're just wanting them to explain it so that their hell can be over. But their hell is far from over, because that's the dad getting moved out of the house, or the uncle, or the mum who's the abuser getting moved out. And then the other children, where do they go? Do they get put in care? So it's hard.
And I suppose as a teacher, it's so helpful for us to be able to hear people like you explain it in such a clear and impassioned way so that we can actually understand that. Because unless we've had those experiences ourselves, we can't begin to understand that.
The best teachers can do, teachers like you can do for children who you suspect is being abused, is to always support them, be there, let them know that you're there for them, so that when that time comes, they can turn to you. You know, but it has to be there because it's. I remember the fear of people finding out, because I knew that it would just rip. And I was the youngest of four. So my brothers and sisters, would they get put into care? My dad, would they get put into jail? I don't know how. I mean, I was a child, so we've got to go back and think retrospectively how my brain would have worked back then. Yeah. But just the fear, you know.
It sounds like such a trite thing to say, but it's so helpful for all of the people who listen. A lot of the people who listen to this are teachers.
Oh, absolutely.
Unpick that. That's so helpful.
And there's people listening going, is she a comedian?
Where's the joke? Come on.
But actually, you've reminded me of what's so difficult for teachers about this period. And it's not learning conversational Russian and doing their makeup because they're all so lazy. It's because they are worried sick about the kids who they know are in vulnerable positions. And I'm going to do a name check now. Waddesdon Manor up near Aylesbury is making food three times a week for kids at our pupil referral unit. And we're taking the food round three times a week to deliver it. But it's not about the food. It's about the food.
You're wrong. It is about the food. You're wrong. It is. I remember being so hungry at school. I never ate from 12 o'clock for the free meal to 12 o'clock the next day. And it is so much about food as well. It left me with issues about food because I starved a lot. So you guys are doing a brilliant job doing that because it is about food as well. There is nothing worse, and I can tell you this just now as a child who's been abused, there is nothing worse than fantasising about food for 8 hours and having none and then getting fed. It's a terrific, horrific scar on your mental capacity to deal with food as an adult, to be well nourished constantly. And I remember eating out of bins. I remember people throwing food away at school and me going and eating it because I was so hungry. So feeding children who are in dire poverty is one of the most important things people can do. We can't always nourish them emotionally, but we can certainly nourish them, nutritionally.
You've just reminded me of this awful free school meals scandal that's happening here. It's probably not happening up in Scotland, but the schools have basically been completely singularly unable to get hold of these vouchers which were promised by the government for families just like this. And we've been hearing from head teachers who've been setting their alarms for 3 a.m. in order to try and get a place in this nonsensical online queue.
So that's ridiculous.
We're 6 weeks into this and these families have been going to the supermarkets trying to hand over these vouchers and being refused. So the humiliation on top of everything else.
Oh, God.
Just shows, doesn't it? Sometimes things feel like they move on so much and then the things that you're talking about from when you were a child are just carrying on for so many of these children.
Seeing kids hungry is just the most awful, awful thing. And walking about hungry as a child is really hard as well. You can't stop thinking about food. And you spend your life just walking about, fantasizing about eating, you know, because you're just hungry. And when you go home and there's no food in the house, I'd get a free school meal the next day.
Yeah.
So I'd go from 12 o'clock on a Tuesday and not be fed until 12 o'clock on a Wednesday. Oh. So not every day, but maybe 2-3 days a week that would happen.
What would happen at the weekend?
I would find people in the family that I knew had food and I'd go visit them. But then I was avoiding the abuser. So it was a proper game of cat and mouse trying to get around the family to make sure he wasn't there. And, you know, somebody's making soup or somebody's got something, you know.
Which goes right back to your point at the beginning, doesn't it, about how school was that safe place to go.
That was a safe haven.
The one thing we always ask as well, which I find fascinating, I suppose as someone who works in the independent sector, I've got a bit more autonomy over what we teach and how we teach it. But if you were in charge of schools, is there anything else that you would add to the curriculum, or is there any other thing that you would get every child in school to learn before they left?
I think one of the things that we didn't get taught, which terrified me, was I was living in the 70s and we weren't taught about the Troubles in Ireland. I still don't know what they are. So we were living through bombs in Belfast in Northern Ireland and in the, you know, in Ireland and Southern Ireland. So there's this huge, we were watching it on the news, but we weren't taught it. So we were taught about the Battle of Hastings and the Bayeux Tapestry in 1066 and King Harold getting an arrow in his eye, but there was a war going on that we weren't informed about. So I think if there was a thing I could add to the school curriculum now, it would be local history to that area, you know, like talk about the conflicts that happened, like the Falklands conflict, like, you know, I don't mean to very young children, but to modern studies. Why was I learning about Theseus and the Minotaur when there was a conflict happening in Ireland that I left school and knew nothing about? I couldn't answer a question about what was happening in, you know, the Irish troubles. And when I saw it on TV, I'm like, and I remember discussing Bernadette Devlin with a teacher, and the conversation gets stopped because the woman couldn't tell me, because obviously she was told not to discuss it.
Yeah.
So I think I would teach local modern history to young people, and the Highland Clearances. We knew nothing about the Highland Clearances. We were taught everything about American slavery, but nothing about what actually happened. And so I would teach local history, local modern history, and history to your own country that seems to be forgotten about.
Yeah, it's
yeah, I think that's really interesting. Go on,
Em. Yeah, I know, it's almost incidental, isn't it? Because when one of the people we interviewed for this podcast was a young lady who'd come over here as a refugee from Afghanistan. And she talks about how those honest conversations about what was happening in the world with her teachers made a huge difference to her.
Mm-hmm.
But they were happening at break. They were happening at lunchtime.
Yeah.
They were incidental. They were happening on the coach on the school trip.
Also, what I would teach children, and this is really important, is I teach children finances. I teach them how set up a business, how to do a tax return, how to arrange a mortgage, how to get a good credit history. Obviously, 15, 16-year-olds, I think that they should be taught basic finance structure in the modern world. Teach young people how to set up a limited company, tell them how to pay a tax man, how to wade through a tax return, how to manage a mortgage, how to make sure that you don't get trapped into debt with Wonga. And I would also have a special class about gambling, the dangers of gambling, and all around finances, because I think young people come out of school, go into university, and they have no decent grasp and knowledge about basic finances. And I had to learn that with my husband, because we were 16, 17 when we got together, and he was autistic. So he managed to always keep a very tight financial record of everything we'd done, which set me in good stead to this day. I've never lost a receipt.
That's incredible.
He's looked at me as if, no, you have lost a receipt.
So, Janie, modern stand-up hat on, what words of inspiration would you give to teachers who are feeling miserable and fed up, who are listening to this at the moment?
I mean, I don't know what I would say to teachers in specific. I think that to people in general, while we're all feeling fed up, is don't feel you have to learn to play the guitar in a new language Duolingo. You don't have to do all that. Yeah. I think that... And I mean, the weird thing is this is the worst time to be creative. I've got a new book deal. I landed a second book deal. In fact, it was auctioned in London to get my book. I can't write this book because my brain is rattled with panic attacks and we're all going to die in the coronavirus, and my whole fridge just smells of bleach, and everybody's just staring at each other. So I'm going to have to write to my publishers and say, and I'm having a problem. So I know how fuggy that can make your brain. So I think at this time, for everybody to feel inspired, is my favourite thing to do is to go on the BFI, the British Film Institute website, and I love looking at really old, and I don't mean old black and white films like Laurel and Hardy. I mean like old films of London and Glasgow back, people just taking film in the street. I am obsessed with that. Just watching all these people who are all dead now, all just walking about really fast and getting on and off trams, and just seeing how the landscape looked back then. And I don't know why I'm looking back so much, but I quite like really old BFI films and their adverts. I love the ones in the 50s. Hello, ladies. Have you thought about slimming? And then they all have to go on a wibbly wobbly board and things. I like all that.
Oh, and our producer has just informed me that all BFI, the entire archive is free on YouTube just now. So there you go, BFI. You're welcome. And your voiceovers, tell us about, I mean, basically, I blame you.
Oh, the Nicola Sturgeon.
I'm not, I'm not getting anything done because I keep having to check in to see if you could done a new voiceover and how Michael Rosen is.
Yeah. So and then she sends it to me, so I'm trying to bit work.
Yeah. I love the fact that Nicola likes them. She was very reserved, wasn't she? But you could tell the twinkle under the reservation.
Yeah.
Oh, the twinkle was lovely.
Well, she knows that what I'm doing is scour the government's speech every day when she comes out and does her address as such. And I try and pick up what it is she's actually saying. Like, for instance, today she was saying that we are going to get fatigue of staying in. We're going to get isolation fatigue. She never said those words, but that's what she's saying. We're all going to get fed up staying in and we're all going to start going out. But you can't, because if you do, there's going to be a spike and we're all going to die if you go out. But she can't say that. So I kind of worm that into the voiceovers and make sure that the message is, you know, the more you go out, the more we stay in. And if you go out, we're going to be locked up to Christmas. So it's up to you guys. So
I
kind of try and get the flavour of what she's saying and put it across in a funny way.
Yeah, with her hairy pelt.
And
the seesaw. Where did the seesaw come from?
The seesaw. I have no idea. I do these in one take. And I just thought, I want to go to the park. Because I look at her hands, and her hands are going up and down. She's like, me and Peter usually go to the swing park and go on the seesaw. We can't do that. And it's silly. It's just silly. And I also do voiceovers for children with no swearing in them through the voice of my wee dog.
Honey's.
Honey does ones that are not sweary, and that's just for children. So children can see a wee dog going, you need to wash your hands, and your mummy's stupid because she isn't washing her hands enough. Like my mummy, Janie doesn't wash her hands when she goes to the toilet for a poo. And kids love that kind of chat. So,
I've heard it. I've seen it. I didn't realise it was you. I don't know how I didn't realise it was you. But yes, my kids love them.
Yeah, so I do once maybe honey talking for children. So children get in the act as well.
Well, on that note, I think that I don't know how you go through that whole process. And Ravna has the impossible job of summarising what we've just talked about. And I don't know where he's going to start with that.
Rav.
Yeah, quite. But Janie, thank you so, so much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating and enlightening and funny and sad and reflective and all of the things it needed to be. So I cannot thank you enough.
Oh, thanks for letting me speak about it. And it's not a subject talking about teachers and education and how it made me feel. It's the first time I've ever really spoke about that. So that's been really nice for me as
exclusive.
Well.
Exclusive. Yes,
exclusive.
It gets better.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. And enjoy the weekend. Who knows? Make the most of what you can do.
Well, tonight I've got my own podcast to do. I've got my live cast at 9 o'clock. And I've got to stay really quiet because my daughter's broadcasting to the nation in her bedroom. So my husband and I have learned how to whisper and sign to each other and make sure Honey doesn't bark in the background while she's on the radio. So we're doing that tonight.
Love it. Well, rock and roll. Lockdown, rock and roll.
Thank you.
So
bye.
Take care. Bye.
I don't know about you, Em, but I genuinely don't know what to say after that. There was so much in that.
I'm feeling quite angry because why? Because I've got all sorts of images in my head. I've got the image of a colleague who had a disclosure made to him, a young lady in a similar position to Jane's with her, where it was her grandfather who was abusing her. And I'll never forget that he talked about how he said to her, excuse me for a second, went into the kitchen, vomited.
Oh my God.
Pulled himself together and went back again. And just the enormity of what some children are carrying around. And then that desire to think, well, actually, it's 2020. Surely by now we've got, as a society, the capacity to pick these children up early to really spot the signs. And actually, it hasn't really changed. I know children who are living in garages. I know children who are living in cars. I know teenagers who are sharing beds with their mothers because that's just the poverty side of it. I actually feel quite angry.
Yeah, and I think for me, Janie answered a question that I've always, and this totally opens up my naivety and my lack of understanding, but I've always wondered why more children don't tell. I've always wondered that, because I think that schools are so good now at creating that environment where they can, that safeguarding is so brilliantly followed in most settings. I know not all, but most. But why children don't tell, or why more children don't. And she's explained that it's not the fear of telling. It's the fear of what that sort of chain of events that will follow. And that makes total sense now someone said that to me. And that's made me really think about what, therefore, within our safeguarding procedures, we need to build in so that that doesn't seem so terrifying. But then equally, we spent 20 minutes laughing. It's just one of those extraordinary podcasts where you're laughing and then feeling desperately sad. And I also want to find Miss Miller. I recognize she's probably not around anymore, but and congratulate her on being an absolute teacher hero. And likewise, Mr. Burgess. Both truly outstanding heroes.
Those teachers sound just amazing. Yeah. It just makes me go all warm when I hear these things.
Me too. And I know that there are lots of Mr. Burgesses, and I know there are lots of Miss Millers in all of our schools, and I'm so proud to be part of that profession. So that, I suppose, that's my finishing point, is just how proud I am of what we all do as teachers and the impact we can have on people's lives. And let's hope that all of our pupils now will be Janie Godleys and other hugely successful people, and we'll be able to see in some small way the impact their school had on them.
You've been listening to the Clement M podcast. As ever, we'd love to hear your anecdotes, thoughts and ideas. You can find us on Twitter at Clement M. Now, we're aware that this has been a highly emotive subject covered in this podcast, and we have some messages for you at the end if you feel this has affected you in any way.
Thank you so much, all of you, for listening and for taking the time to just have a think about the things we've been talking about and hearing about. Until next time, stay in lockdown, stay safe and keep in touch. Thank you so much.
See you next time.
The Clement M podcast, presented by Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest Janie Godley. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clement M podcast is a Those That Can production. If you or someone you know has been affected by the issues discussed, you can get in touch with the Samaritans around the clock every single day of the year by phone on 08457 90 90 90 or by email on joe@samaritans.org.